You're in your way.
Huh?
You're mine.
Okay. So, I spent a lot of time on a few examples Thursday. Let me try and start with some more big picture stuff here. So, you have some kind of sequence. Let's say that it starts at term zero, just to have fewer letters wandering around. And there's nothing's really different if we started at index C for some other end or C, but I think it's going to be a little easier to read if we just pick a starting index and just go with it from what's there. Yeah, let's shut that door. Okay. Now, the big picture for all these convergence tests is you use something you know about sequences to tell you something about series, right? So this basic one, if the sequence of partial sums converges, right, it has a limit, then it is Cauchy. And the converse, right, which is a special property of the real numbers, if the sequence is Cauchy, then it converges. And another way we get, another way we can get convergence, so I'm assuming Cauchy, we assume if, for example, the sequence is increasing and bounded above, then it converges. So all of these facts allow you to prove corresponding facts about series. This one is probably the easiest one. There's a very natural correspondence, right? Because if you look, is a sequence increasing? I'm just adding up all these terms. You go add one more term. So the sequence is increasing in the context of a sequence of partial sums, it's increasing if and only if the next term is non-negative, right? Maybe I should put the zero on the other side. It's probably more natural. So, that's the connection with three. Way back in chapter 1, we had this somewhat informal argument about decimal expansions. If something is bounded above and it's increasing, it converges to something. So if all the terms in your sequence are non-negative, or all the terms in your series, I should say, then the partial sums are an increasing . So if you have an upper bound for all the partial sums, then there is an actual limit, right? And of course, that limit will be at most that upper bound that you found for the partial sums. So it will converge. If you can just show that every partial sum is bounded for some reason, bounded above. And you're talking about non-negative terms. Well, how do we use, for example, this business about if something converges and it's Cauchy? We talked about that one last time a bit, right? It's often called the divergence test or limit test or nth term test.
So I have to be careful of all these little.
I guess here we're starting at zero, aren't we? Try and keep it straight. Remember, if you're Cauchy, then for any epsilon, for m and n large, the sm and sn, the terms of this sequence of partial sums, have to be epsilon close together. Late terms in the sequence are all close together. The partial sum sequence stabilizes. Now, in particular, let it be... N and N plus 1, right? You let N be large, then N plus 1 is also large, right? Which implies that what's the difference between these two partial sums? Just one term. Terms in your series are getting close to zero as long as n is large enough. So, the actual terms in the sequence must converge to zero. And of course, the contrapositive is usually more useful, is not always. Sometimes you use it in this direction. A lot of times you end up using the contrapositive version if you want to do a convergence test. If the terms don't converge to zero, then the series also does not converge. And I gave a direct proof of this last time. The contrapositive statement is actually easier to prove. But I wanted to show you a direct proof last time.
It gives a little bit more insight than just saying, oh, it's the contrapositive sort of thing.
So that is how that was how we were using one fact one right there. Convergent sequences are Cauchy. Okay. Fact two gets used for a whole bunch of different tests. Use the Cauchy Cauchy implies convergence as much as I like to use it. So I'm not going to prove everything the same way the book proves it. So the big ones are the ratio test and root test. The idea is to essentially we're going to compare to a geometric series, right. Now the idea is, if you have a series of powers of R, and you start at a large power n, and R is smaller than 1, then your geometric series formula for this will just be R to the n minus R to the n plus 1 over 1 minus R. How big is this thing? Well, the 1 minus R will be positive. Pull out R to the n. The R to the n will be small, and then you'll have 1 minus R to the n plus 1 minus n. And this will also be positive. Because remember that if you have something between 1 and negative 1, its positive powers are also between 1 and negative 1. So 1 minus something between 1 and negative 1 will be between 0 and 2. Right? So the 1 minus R is between 0 and 2. This 1 minus some positive power of R also between 0 and 2. And so the idea is, well, okay, I don't know. If n is large, though, and r is smaller than 1, then this r to the n is going to be a small number. And we can, if you want, you know, you can just, this part with the m here, you can just round it up to 2. Good. And the idea is, if the n is really large, then this should be really small, right? The 1 minus r is just a constant. The 2 is a constant. The only thing that's changing now is that we're varying this m and n here. So this should be small. So when you're comparing partial sums, SM and SN, right, you're going to get something like this. If you can show that your series is smaller than some geometric series. Usually, we actually end up with the absolute value bars on the inside. So it makes for us. You do have to be slightly careful about that kind of thing, because as I've written it here, I've got the absolute value bars on the outside. So there could be some cancellation, but I'd like to be able to show that I get something small even if there is no cancellation. Usually, though, we'll be looking at something that's just positive.
How does this work?
Okay. I think the root test is the simpler one to understand. Then we'll go to the ratio test. Have a limit that's less than 1 of the nth roots of the magnitudes of the terms of the series, then your series converges. And I mean, here, of course, it doesn't matter whether I wrote a K or an N or an I or whatever, right? As long as they match. Likewise here, I mean, I could have written any letter I wanted as long as they match. I could have used J for all of them, yeah, whatever. Okay. Proof. This is maybe one half of the root test. Let me tell you the other half before I jump into a proof. If you remember from Calculus 2, you know the other half, right? The second half is just going to be using this kind of nth term test. The second half is not the really interesting thing. The interesting thing is the first half. You actually get slightly more than just convergence. You actually get convergence even with absolute value sign. Right? Of course, note that if I put absolute value bars around something twice, right, that's the same as if I just put them around it once, right? The absolute value of negative 5 is 5. The absolute value of that is still 5. Right? If I replace these terms a sub k with their absolute value bars a sub k, then I get double absolute value bars in here. So I'd still be getting the same limit. So that's really good. Okay. So the idea is we want to compare to some convergent geometric series for the first half. Okay, so maybe let's, to be clear here, we're talking about the first half, the L less than 1. So it turns out you need to give yourself a little bit of room. You can't use the L directly. It doesn't quite work. So you pick a number between L and 1. Right? Then if you're like, well, how do I do that? Well, take the midpoint, for example. Right? It doesn't have to be the midpoint, but just something between L and 1, strictly between. Now remember, I guess the sequence location theorem from chapter 5, if you converge to some number L, right, then you're eventually close to L, right? In particular, you're eventually going to always be less than R. So that means there exists a wait time, right, such that beyond that wait time, the nth root of the magnitude of the nth term of the series is less than R, right? Because eventually they're all close to L. So make them epsilon close to L. Wait that long. And once the epsilon close to L, where you've chosen epsilon to be, you know, the distance from L to R, say, then they have to be less than R. Okay. Now, but what do we need to prove? We want to show that our sequence of partial sums is Cauchy, right? Because Cauchy is equivalent to convergence. So, okay. So it's actually forgetting about, you know, distance between L and R, let's just think about any positive epsilon. Okay. We will find another wait time, M, okay, capital M, such that for all M and N at least that big, the difference between the partial sums is less than epsilon. So show that things stabilize. Okay. Now what we need is this kind of estimate here. And the R we've chosen is going to be positive, so we're not going to really have to worry about all those absolute value bars over there. So, starting at this wait time where we've got that comparison to R, we could already do some stuff. Right? Let's look at the size. For example, let's suppose that first we pick a little n, then we pick an even later lowercase m. And no matter what we pick, I claim that this, we can make it small. We may have to wait longer than capital M, but we can make it small. So let's see. What's going to happen when we do the cancellation? We're going to have A0 plus a bunch of terms all the way until we get to AM. Here we only go as far as AN. So what's not canceled is this. That's what's not canceled. And that, well, we can use the triangle inequality on that. Now, we have our comparison here, right? We know that the nth root for large numbers, lowercase n, anything after this wait time capital N, we have this comparison with the nth root. So if you raise it now to the, if you raise a term to the corresponding power, you have a comparison with a power of r. So this magnitude, a sub n plus 1, since n plus 1 is after that wait time capital N, that's going to be, that term is smaller in size than r to the n plus 1. Then the next term is smaller than r to the n plus 2, and so on, all the way to r plus m. This is just, okay, geometric series time. Now, everything, I mean, the r's are positive. The 1 minus r is also positive. So this is actually, since this is just positive stuff here, you don't even have to mess around with the absolute values. You just round this term up to 0. Okay. We're almost there. We just need to wait long enough for this thing to be less than epsilon. Well, that's not a problem. The limit, say, is k goes to infinity of r to the kth power is 0, right? Because r is smaller than 1. Why is r greater than 0? How do I sneak that in there? Why?
The r is non-negative because it's between L and 1.
Between L and 1, and strictly greater than L. So as long as L is not negative, r is strictly positive. How do I know L is not negative?
Don't we have the absolute values? I mean, that's so we can make it positive, so we don't work with any negative numbers.
We're taking the limit of non-negative things. So that's the one of the limit location theorems, yes. So the limit will also be non-negative, right? So that's how we know that since it's strictly bigger than L and L is not negative, we know it's positive. All right. And okay, so this goes to 0. If we divide by a 1 minus r, that's also going to go to 0. Because that's the 1 minus r is just a constant. So choose m such that all you just need that the I mean really you just need to make sure that this thing here is small, so just choose it. All we really care about is the r to the n. I mean, if you're worried about the plus one, you know, you shouldn't be because, just put another factor of r in there, right? There's your plus one. That's just another constant factor. So that's it. You have now the difference between two partial sums are always going to be epsilon apart, less than epsilon apart, by this comparison of the geometric series. The only other trick is when we choose this wait time, It has to not only wait for the for this geometric series estimate to be small, it also has to wait for this estimate on the nth roots to become valid. So you choose that wait time capital M to be at least as long as the first wait time we got. So choose it to be at least capital N. And then you'll have waited long enough such that our whole chain of arguing from here all the way to there to less than epsilon is valid. And you'll notice that if I had switched things around with N greater than M, then right, this wouldn't change anything, right? It would, you know, the absolute value would be the same, and my notation would just look different. I just have an N here and an M here. And I'd end up with, you know, an M here, but wouldn't change anything. And if M and N are equal, then this distance is zero, which is certainly less than epsilon. So really, this case handles, you know, all the other cases by, you know, just by symmetry. Nothing changes if you flip the order there. So that's how we show, you know, very abstractly, that if you have this limit less than one of the nth roots of the terms, then the series has to stabilize just because a bigger geometric series stabilizes. And the proof for L bigger than one is much shorter. Right? And that. Now you put the R the other way. Now R is bigger than 1. And then you have that the magnitude of AN is greater than R, okay, let's start with the nth root, okay? So the nth root of the magnitude of n is greater than R for n large because it's converging to this even bigger number L. So you get this nth power, though, right? But R is bigger than 1. So the nth power of R is going to go to infinity as n goes to infinity. So you have a problem, right? If the magnitude of n is going to infinity, then the actual values, whether they're positive or negative, are definitely not going to zero. Okay. So the series diverges. So that's much easier. The point is, if the nth roots are bigger than 1, then the actual terms must be huge for n large. So definitely not going to converge. Can't stabilize, and every next term is even bigger and bigger.
Questions or comments?
So the comparison with the geometric series for the ratio test is similar. You have to do a slightly more algebra I mean, here all you had to do was undo the nth root by taking nth power.
And you got these nice comparisons.
With this ratio, you have to do a bunch of multiplication where a bunch of things are multiplied, but then you're multiplying by fractions, and there's lots of numerators and lots of denominators that all cancel. So we need to be actually doing some division here. So we're going to assume right off the bat that we're not dividing by zero. You really only need this for n large. So you look at the ratio of consecutive terms. And you'll notice that, again, L has to be non-negative because we're looking at a sequence of non-negative numbers there. Actually, all the numbers have to be positive if we're assuming that all the terms are non-zero. Either way, the limit has to be non-negative. So, like before, if this limiting ratio instead of limiting root is less than 1, then your series converges. Doesn't matter what letters I use there as long as they match. And it doesn't really matter whether I start at 0 or some other integer, right? It would just, starting somewhere else would just add or take away finitely many terms. It won't change whether you converge or diverge or not. You just tack on some constant. Okay. And as before, if you put absolute value bars on it, you know, you're gonna have the same limit here. So actually you get what they call absolute convergence, right? The series converges even if there's no even without the help of canceling positive and negative terms. Okay, so we'll do this limit. Okay, so I'm going to do the L greater than 1 case first. That's a short case, right? There's a number of ways you can approach it. But the basic idea is that, like before, we want to show that the terms don't converge to zero. Now, if you're multiplying every term approximately by some ratio L that's bigger than 1, then the terms should be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They shouldn't be converging to zero. Okay. So then we pick an R between L and 1. And then we pick a wait time. So beyond that wait time, this ratio, which is converging to L, has become strictly bigger than R. Actually, we don't really need the strictness. I mean, greater than or equal to would be enough. In any case, we have more than we have. All right, so R. And then if you look at any term, you have this nice little result here that its magnitude looks like this. Write it as A sub n times what? First fraction starts from a fraction. You divide by the preceding term. Okay, but wait, now you've changed things. Undo it. Multiply by another ratio. Now the ans cancel. Why don't I write as fractions instead of the slashes? Probably easier to see. Okay? An over an minus 1 times an minus 1 over an minus 2, an minus 2 over an minus 3 times. Keep going all the way until you're back at the capital N. Cancels except the very first numerator and the very last denominator. Well, okay, but wait, I only have the first numerator there, so how do I cancel that one? Well, okay, tack on one more thing at the end. Just an A capital N there. Now, everything cancels except the original, right? A sub lowercase n there. And you look at all of those ratios now, and they're all bigger than R. And this guy, the A sub capital N, is non-zero. So you get a whole bunch of factors here. How many factors? Well, let's see. Capital N equals 1, lowercase n. If, for example, if lowercase n was capital N plus 2, for example, then you have two factors. If lowercase n is capital N plus 5, then we have five factors. So in general, we have this many factors. And we round all those factors down to this constant R. And you just factor out this. Now, what's interesting here? We have the R to the N, and we can take N to infinity, and then the other stuff is just constants. The capital N is just, we pick this constant wait time, right? Capital R and capital N is constant, as you pick. So, and crucially, this number here, A sub capital N, is not zero by assumption. Okay. So this far right fraction here is not zero. Okay. And of course the R is chosen to be greater than one such that, so it's actually got to be positive. And then we're multiplying by R to the N, but R is bigger than one. R to the N goes to infinity. Therefore, you hit it with a constant multiple like that. That also, a non-zero constant multiple, I should say. That also goes to infinity. So this is a non-zero positive constant multiple. But that means that we have our actual terms, the magnitudes of the A sub n's, are greater than or equal to this thing, which is going to infinity. So for n large, these terms are even bigger, so they must go to infinity too. Well, if these terms are going to infinity, then just like before, if their magnitudes get big as you take n large, then certainly they're not converging to zero. Right? But if they're not converging to zero, then as before, the series definitely not converging. Same as before. It's a little bit more elaborate in actually getting the lower bound. Right? Here, the lower bound that went off to infinity was really easy to get. But it can still be done. And this same algebraic trick gets used in the L less than 1 case to prove you're convergent. You just get lots of cancellations. That means the number between is less than 1, and of course it'll be positive. And then we choose a wait time. So after that wait time, we have the sequence location theorem. Since the ratios are going to L in magnitude, the magnitudes of those ratios will eventually be always less than R. Here we have them always, eventually always greater than R, because we picked R to be on the other side of L. Okay, so then you do the same trick here. Except now the inequality goes the other way. It's the exact same algebraic trick. The inequality reversed because the inequality of the ratio has been reversed. The fractions all get rounded up to R instead of getting rounded down to R. Look at the difference between consecutive terms, you get the exact same kind of thing. And now this basically, at this point, now it's basically the same. We're rounding up to powers of R, except we have a constant multiple floating around in there. So we get, we pull the, so the constant multiple is this, right? Pulling out that constant multiple, you have r to the n plus 1. Or power of that to r to the n. Right, so this kind of estimate just now of a constant multiple in it. Okay, and then this thing, since the r is less than 1, it's going to go to 0, right? We do the same estimate like over there. So there's this constant multiple of n times, just from the geometric series estimate, just like we did for the root test. And you can write this as, for example, if you want to cancel that one there, you can write it like this. Now, since that goes to 0, given any epsilon, we can choose a wait time capital N like before. So first we have to choose the wait time to be at least long enough to make this ratio estimate valid. And then second, we just need to wait long enough for this thing here to get small. And so we have this, again, there's this constant factor, this part. Interesting part, the r to the n. Since r is smaller than 1, the r to the n will eventually be really small, and so will constant multiples of it. So eventually this inequality is always true. We also wait long enough for the first inequality we had here, based on the ratio estimates, to always be true. And then you put it all together, like we did before. The difference between partial sums is less than something which is less than something else, which is less than epsilon. Exact same thing. So the series has to stabilize, because if you look at any two partial sums where you added a whole lot of terms, at least capital M many terms together, or if you want to be really precise, say at least as far out as index capital M, now those two partial sums will be less than epsilon apart. So you are converging to something. The series is stabilizing. Book gives a somewhat slightly different proof in that instead of proving this Cauchy type epsilon claim, it uses the comparison right here to show that all the partial sums are bounded above. But the cost is that then you have to make an extra step. You have to say, well, the sum of the magnitudes therefore converge because they're also non-negative terms. And then from that, you have to use the result that if you're absolutely convergent, then you're convergent. But I like this one because it's very direct. I don't have to make an extra step switching between series of absolute values and series of original terms. Cauchy. Now, somewhat confusingly, there's something in the book called the Cauchy criterion. which has nothing to do with Cauchy series. Just because Cauchy was awesome and had lots of stuff named after him. The Cauchy criterion is what you probably were told was called the alternating series test in Calculus 2. And actually, the calculus book we use here, there's actually a place where it calls, you know, this kind of epsilonics here, it actually calls it Cauchy's convergent criterion. So, yeah, just watch out. The names can get all flipped around depending which book you're reading. The last time I used this book, Mattock, you know, I remember that what it calls the first fundamental theorem of calculus and the second fundamental theorem of calculus, my calculus book that I teach with calls the second fundamental theorem and the first fundamental theorem. Names are switched, so. Always ask for a definition. I'm not sure what somebody's talking about. It's, sometimes these names, you know, they're not the same everywhere. Okay, so. Anyways. Cauchy's criterion / alternating series test. Okay, so in this scenario, you have a decreasing sequence of non-negative terms, okay? So, I mean, the way to think about this, of course, is not so much like that, more like think about it this way. But if you want to know what the dot, 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 dot is supposed to mean, it means that. Right? So, decreasing non-negative sequence. Moreover, we require that the sequence actually converge to zero, not just keep decreasing and say converge down to a half, but it actually converges all the way down to zero. And again, it's really not important where you have the starting index. That only changes things by adding or not some finite constant. But just for concreteness, let's say we have a starting index at zero. This one is a little different. It uses the fact that bounded monotone sequences converge. But it uses it twice. Okay. So the easiest way that I have to understand why it's true, and then that guides me in coming up with a formal proof, is I think about it this way. First of all, I mean, if you think about this notation, even powers of negative 1 are positive, odd powers are negative. So when I write this, what do we mean? We say, okay, a0, right, because 0th power, negative 1 is 1, minus a1, plus a2, minus a3, plus a4, minus a5, and so on. So it really should converge, but here's the easy picture, right? You think of it as, here's 0, and we go up a0, the first term. Then we go down, negative a1. So right here, this is the first partial sum, right? S0 there. And then the second partial sum is right here, S1. Then we go up a2. Now we're at the third partial sum, S2 there. And we go down A3. And you notice each time we don't go as far, right? Because the terms are getting smaller. So now you have S3, fourth partial sum. You go up, but not as far. A4. Now you've got your fifth partial sum. S4 here. Mm-hmm. And then you really can see the pattern now, right? So the next one. S5, adding up terms A0 through A5, right? With the appropriate signs. So the picture we see here is that the evenly indexed partial sums form a decreasing sequence, which is definitely bounded below. On the other hand, we have the odd-indexed partial sums, which form an increasing sequence, which is definitely bounded above. I mean, any of these evenly indexed partial sums would be an upper bound for it. So I preempted the first one. Okay? And you can... And the third fact that you need to see that, okay, I have these two things. Even indices should converge to something because it's a decreasing sequence bounded below. Increasing sequence bounded above also should converge to something. The only question is, do they converge to the same thing? We need one more fact, right? It's just that if you have an odd term, an oddly indexed term minus an evenly indexed term, right? That's just, what's the difference between S2 and S3? It's just A3. Right? And generally, you'd have a formula like this. And those differences are going to zero by hypothesis. Okay? So these two sequences, since their differences go to zero, by our limit laws, they have to converge to the same thing. And you can turn the picture into something, you know, slightly, you know, more formal, you know. So for example, you could write S2 times n plus 1 minus S2 n, right? What would that be? Well, that would just be terms negative A2 n plus 1, because it's an odd index, gets a negative power, plus A2n, or even index, positive power. Well, which of these two terms is bigger? The earlier one, right? And similarly, if you were looking at oddly indexed stuff, right? You'd get, make sure I got this right here. 2n No, I didn't get it right. That's my mistake. It's 2n plus 2 here, right? This is 2n plus 2. The 2n gets canceled. Sorry about that. This is the right one. Okay, so this one you have negative s 2n plus 3 plus S2n plus 2. And this time, the positive A. Odd index. Plus even index. This time, the even index one comes earlier. Right? The earlier terms are the bigger terms. So. Okay.
So this is how you would more, you know, if you wanted to more formally show that the sequences really are monotone, right? And I guess one more thing that we should have in here, I guess, is the fact that they're bounded. Which you can do. Should we do that? Okay. So we want to show they're bounded. Okay, so the idea with that is. It's easier to just show that these comparisons here, 0, S0, S1, S4, you just show that these comparisons are always, as I've shown, the even indexed ones are always above the odd indexed ones. I mean, of course, one of these is easy, right? The first one. Because the very first partial sum is just the first term. And then if you go to the next one, the S1, it's underneath S0 because S1 is equal to what? You have A0, right? That's S0. Then you subtract so that shows S1 is below S0. And then you do it by induction. So if you had, say, S sub 2k plus 1 less than or equal to S sub 2k, then what happens? You want to show the next level. So how do we compare? So we want to show that S sub 2k plus 2 actually gives us. S sub 2k plus 3 would be the next odd one. So that's going to be 2k plus 1 plus then the 2k term, the a minus 2k plus 1 term. All right. No, it's 4. Plus 2. All the terms through 2k plus 1 are in the partial sum. Then you have these two more terms. And you want to get this to be less than or equal to S sub 2k plus 2. So that at this stage, you can do, from that stage, you can do just the next stage. Okay, so what's S sub 2k plus 2? Well, that's not hard, right? This term here, you're subtracting a non-negative number. So you can just round that up to 0. I guess we don't even really need induction. It's clearer than that, right? Just do a direct proof. For all k, S sub 2k plus 1 is the terms up through A2k, but then you have an odd index term, so you're doing a subtraction. So you really do have our picture. That this is the formal proof. That they really are monotone and they have their bounds. Because we showed that even ones partial sums decrease, odd ones partial sums increase. And this argument is easy to show, actually, that each odd one came from subtracting a number from the previous even one. That was easier than I thought. So I formalized it a bit more. And I guess I said it out loud. I could add it, I guess, write it down. So we have a sequence, odd ones. So the even indexed ones and the odd indexed ones converge to some numbers. Because they're bounded in monotone sequences. But we have this fact up here, right? The difference between them goes to zero. That's the argument. You show that the partial sums for the out to an odd index converge to a number, and the partial sums out to an even index converge to the very same number. Arguably, we've got the essential idea. You might say that we need to do just a little bit more to make it a honest to goodness proof here. What more needs to be said? Okay. Okay. So partial sums converge to some common number L. All right. Oh, are you sure that the original sequence converges? Yes, because it's basically made up of two other sequences that converges. Right. So if you want to be informal about the last part, you say it's like, given positive epsilon, choose N large enough such that. Such that two things, right? Such that for all n, at least capital N, you have evenly indexed ones, epsilon close to L, and you also have the oddly indexed partial sums, epsilon close to L. Okay? All right. Well, then for all n at least half of capital N, either n is even or odd, but in either case, you will have that it is epsilon close to L. That's the proof of that. I think what's important to note about this is that the alternating signs are very important, and there's delicate situations. So, for example, this diverges, but by this alternating series test,
even though the so-called harmonic series diverges, the alternating harmonic series converges. This is probably the most well-known instance of how this thing can make a difference. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. So for the test, any handwritten notes are fine. If you want to bring a photocopy of something that you wrote in your handwriting, that's fine too. Send me an email or come to my office if you have another question about that. Okay. Good luck on Thursday.